Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 458th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. I'll give you an American perspective, our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You get your daily reading from me and other writers over at onceametro.com and the rest of the SB Nation family of soccer websites. Come on in. The chat room is open. Talk amongst yourselves if you like. If you have a question for me, I'll try to answer it to the best of my abilities. And as we continue on with this COVID-19 pandemic, it sounds like there are some good news going through this pandemic. Of course, we are seeing the amount of, depending on what state you live in, the amount of deaths rescinding. Which is very good. I'm very happy to see that. The hospitals are not admitting as much. That's also positive. But once again, we're still not out of the woods, obviously. Some have said that we have not yet peaked. Some have said that we have peaked and we're ready to move forward from this. But until we get real news, I am not going to claim that everything is all back to normal or we're on the verge of going back to normal. I will make sure that I get it straight from the horse's mouth, that we can all agree or disagree on what the situations are happening. So, you know, in this intro monologue, obviously – some news have come out from U.S. soccer, of course. One of those news is, of course, the Development Academy Leagues have now been scrapped, and Major League Soccer, it looks like, will be taking that over, as they will be the ones to handle the whole Developmental Academy situation now that U.S. soccer is no longer part of it. Is that good or is that bad? All I can say right now is this, is that depending on what side you are for or against this, all I can say is that I think U.S. soccer might have bitten more than they could chew. They might have bitten off more than they can chew. And you know, while it's hard to see this happening, who knows? Maybe this is a blessing in disguise in some ways because, you know, does U.S. soccer, are they really trying to manage all these youth academies with all the money that they're trying to spend? And because of that situation – that, you know, they want to try and spend and get into youth soccer to try and make it stronger and better, you know, was this the road they really wanted to go down on? Is this the road they really wanted to, you know, spend their monies and stuff? Because as of right now, as we have seen in recent days popping up, just finding out now that U.S. soccer has now been given, I believe it's a grant, because of the whole situation that I guess whatever that is, the whole situation of you know, the lawsuit that they have to go through with the women's national team players. The Open Cup, of course, has been so far at the moment still suspended, lost revenue there, of course. They have applied for a loan via the Payroll Protection Program as part of the CARES, this whole CARES situation. You know, they had a great surplus from the Copa America Centenario that was here back in 2016. Then, of course, now all that money, over $160 million, now depleted to $40 million over the next 2.5 years. You know, they're expecting this revenue shortfall. All I know is, and by the way, that's from Bob Williams, of course, if you want to follow him on Twitter, at WilliamsBob75, who posted this. This is also from, of course, from ESPN as well, citing this as well. It's a situation where it's really been, I guess, really hard to see what U.S. soccer is going through. And Jeff Carlisle of ESPN FC has written this article at the same time. So once again, credit to Jeff Carlisle from ESPN. You can go to ESPN.com. Bob Williams, of course, is also tweeting it as well on Twitter. But Jeff Carlisle wrote it for MLS's ESPN, for ESPN FC. Excuse me. And, you know, it comes to a situation of what the heck is going on in U.S. soccer now financially and what they're trying to do. As I've said already, they have already decided to end the developmental academy leagues. And, it, you know, was that a smart thing to do? Some will say yes and some will say no. But once again, it's a situation where is our federation a mess? I don't want to say that it is, but, you know, I'm concerned about what is going on within the federation. Forget the whole thing about, okay, you believe that MLS and U.S. soccer are connected, they're corrupt and all that stuff. And what type of corruption are we talking about here? I'd like to find out from some of these so-called people that are saying, you know, U.S. soccer and MLS are corrupt. And fire Don Garber and CONCACAF and FIFA should be forcing, you know, even Carlos Cordero, and even though they've forgotten that Carlos Cordero is no longer president of U.S. soccer, but at the same time, being president of U.S. soccer doesn't mean a whole ball of wax when it's the board of governors that has the say. That the president of the federation of the sport in this country does not mean a damn thing anymore these days. Because, to be honest, it's just really a mirage. You say the emperor has no clothes? Well, U.S. soccer has no president. And that's the truth. Regardless of who is taking over that spot, whether it's Cindy Parlow Cohn, if she does take over, what is she going to do? Does she speak for herself? Does she speak for the board? Or does she speak for the game? We don't know. I don't know. And I will reserve my judgments until we see some real movement here within the federation. Like I said, there's a lot going on right now that I don't know about. There's a lot going on that I really, really don't know about. And until I get a better information and learning about what's going on, I will give a better opinion on it. But right now, it feels like our federation is in a time of haphazardness. If you're thinking it's a rudderless ship, I hate to say it, but it has that feeling that it is currently a rudderless ship. regardless of Jay Berhalter leaving U.S. Soccer and joining MLS or in some form of capacity, forget all that. The point is this. The direction that our federation right now is in, there is no direction. If they can come up, clear their heads, get together, I think for sure, I think it'll be a lot better. But all I can say is that you know, until things get better, things are clear and fixed, we will hopefully see our federation get back on track. That is the situation that's in front of us right now. That is the situation that we are going to have to get into once everything has been wrapped up in a nice ball and we can move forward and we get back to what's more important. What is in front of us? Who's going to be on this national team? What are they going to do in friendlies, World Cup qualifying, the World Cup itself, the Gold Cup as well? What will happen then? Until we get there, right now, it's a big mystery. It's going to be a big mystery, and until then, we don't know where we're going. We don't know what's in front of us. I think right now, this whole COVID-19 situation, I believe U.S. Soccer should use this time to just sit back, relax, take a couple of deep breaths, and then plan out accordingly of what needs to happen and what to do to move forward. Because as of right now, whatever has been working since Sunil Gulati has left, whatever has been working since not qualifying for the World Cup in Russia, what we have witnessed and what we have seen is a situation of haphazardness and a feeling that this federation is lost. We cannot have that. If we are going to have a president to truly, or a person, whether, you know, doesn't matter who it is, male or female, does not matter. If we can have a president that can just put their foot down, move forward, and if that is Cindy Parlow Cohn, if it is her, to move this federation forward, to have her stand up and say, you know what, these are my ideas, this is what we have to do for both the men and the women, for the boys and the girls of all of our national teams, then this is what we're going to have to do moving forward. If she can get this federation back on track, then we are back to normal. I wish her all the luck. I wish her good luck. I want her to do well. I want her to go out there because she has the right ideas to make this federation better. That's what we need to do. And that is what has to happen. Because if not, we're going to go down a black hole and it's not going to be pretty. It is not going to be pretty at all. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to tonight's show. I've got a wonderful guest coming on tonight. And you know what? I'm very honored to have this man coming on my show tonight because why? He's one of those pioneers that helped bring Major League Soccer into the forefront. At the same time, very, very well-known athlete back in the day when he was part of that wonderful movement, the 1990 World Cup team, the 94 World Cup team. Of course, a local from Kearney, New Jersey, who was a part of the original Metro Stars Club, a U.S. Soccer Hall of Famer, and now a broadcaster. The one and only, the great Tony Miola has joined me tonight. Tony, good evening and welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for having me. Hopefully everyone on your end is safe and sound, and hopefully we get out of all this mess here sometime in the near future.
Absolutely, and I wish for you and your family as well to be safe and sound during this very trying time in this whole coronavirus situation. But, Tony, first things first. Yes, I saw Tom McCabe's documentary about Soccer City USA. I saw the whole situation involving yourself, John Harkes, and Tab Ramos. You bad boy. How could you? Those Kearney soccer teams teasing the opposition the way you did. How dare you? I should call the principal on you right now. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah, well, they were going back whatever it's been now, 25, 30 years, and sort of having everyone relive it the way that they did was pretty cool. You know, it's a special place. It still is a special place. And people over the years, I mean, there's been stories written about three guys from Kearney, and everyone used to joke, you know, is it in the water and all of that stuff. And I'm just kind of glad it's for sports fans in this country, in these days. It's really hard, I think, for people to get a real grasp of what it was like. And I think that it's pretty good. Tom and his guys and Kiki, they did a pretty good job of sort of portraying really what it was like, you know, what the days looked like there and what kids were interested there, because I don't know that existed in too many places around the country. And I kind of have said for years, I wish that kids would grow up in an environment where I love the structure, and I'm a structure guy in general, but when it comes to soccer, man, I just wish they would just get out and play for the love of it. I don't know that we have enough of that, and I don't know that that's ever coming back. Not only here, though, by the way, we hear this all over the world as well. I just, those days, I think you just learn so much from those moments.
I agree with you. And I mean, you probably not only, you know, with your friends, of course, with you on the national team, but at the same time, your friends from the old neighborhood, to hear them talk about what you did, how it was organized, whether it be through the high schools or the local town or just pickup games in Kearney, it was just wonderful to hear all that stuff, you know, like from you, from John, from Tab, John's father, your friends. It was so refreshing to hear all this wonderful talk about those days back in the old neighborhood.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of things that for me, you know, for anyone can imagine that you're in this thing and now there's a movie made about it. But there's one sort of line, and I think it was Mike O'Neill, who's one of the pioneers of PDA in New Jersey and is now the women's coach at Rutgers. The one thing that stuck out to me that, I don't know if it was passed over, but someone mentioned it to me the next day. So I know at least two people saw it, myself being one of them. When he said in the one part, when he said, you know, by the time we got to soccer training at night, we had already played soccer three times that day. We played before school, we played at lunchtime, and we played after school. And then we went to soccer training. I'm thinking to myself when he was saying this, I said, you know what? It's so true. And I'm not suggesting that that's the way everyone has to be. I just wonder if there's anyone that does that. Is there anyone in this day and age that can say that that's what they did? Because we are so structured, and the structure is great. But I go back to those moments and think how much I learned in those moments, and you know, the fights we had and the battles we had and the screaming and yelling at each other and trying to, you know, figuring it out on your own, as they used to say, you know. I hope that we get to a point where we get some of that back at some point. But yeah, look, it's just a thrill to be part of, for sure.
I bet it was, and it was really well done by Tom. I had him on last week, and great. I watched it probably three times already, and I'm still laughing at some of the fun parts, especially your buddy that would have gone streaking if you would have had the clean sheet against Colombia in the second group stage game. But anyway,
saved you guys a poor vision. That's for sure.
Anyway, I want to go back to that wonderful day down in Trinidad and Tobago. I want, from your perspective, before you got to the stadium, flying in from the U.S. to that island nation, the biggest qualifying match in your national team career at that point in time, landing there, the experience from the natives till you get to the game, till you get to that stadium. What was the feeling like to go basically at the time enemy territory to a sea of red and black?
It was pretty intimidating. We got there and it all started the night before. I mean, we had no idea. We had heard, you know, that it's going to be crazy. They had already deemed it a national holiday the following Monday, and the whole country wasn't going to work, and so on and so forth. And I mean, we were a bunch of college kids for the most part. We were a bunch of kids that, you know, like most kids today, we were no different in the fact that they just wanted to play in a World Cup. I mean, that's what soccer players want to do. You know, you want to play professionally and you want to play in a World Cup. And that was that seemed, based on sort of what what had taken place over, you know, 40 years and what the Federation was working towards and how we were working and thinking, that just seemed like the next logical step was to be part of, qualifying for a World Cup. Of course, they tried to do it in 1986, and in that group of three, Costa Rica beat them out in that group. Canada went through in the World Cup as well, so they didn't get it done then, and they thought they were so close. This just seemed like the right time, the right sort of momentum, the right group of players, the right attitude, the right mentality, the right head coach. And we ended up getting it done in a very unfriendly environment. I've played in some unfriendly environments. That one, as unfriendly as it was, you never felt like you were in danger. The Trinidadian, it's Trinidad and Tobago, fans were as kind and cordial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were as kind and cordial as they could have been, and you would have expected them to be, but I mean, they had a mission, and that was to get to the World Cup like us, and we were just a goal better on the day.
You know, absolutely. Nothing can be said anymore. What Paul Caligiuri did, took that shot and just surprised the hell out of the keeper to get you guys to Italy in 1990. And then going on to hosting the World Cup in 1994, what did it feel like for you as an American to having the biggest sporting event, forget even the Olympics, to have the biggest soccer sporting event to come to our country, and for you to play in Detroit against Switzerland, again, Colombia in LA or Pasadena, I believe it was, at the Rose Bowl, Romania, and then Brazil. I mean, what was it like to have that setting come to our shores?
Well, I mean, if you know my background, being of Italian heritage, if there were two places in the world I would have picked to play a World Cup, it would have been Italy and the U.S. You know, and geez, it came true. My dreams came true, and I kind of feel like Italy was sort of a warm up and an understanding. You know, an understanding of what the next step to be able to compete at a World Cup level would look like. And I think we all kind of worked in that mode. We took our beating and our lesson, and we were college kids. I don't think any of us went down and thought, hey, we're going to win a World Cup. We're going to compete with everyone. We needed some lessons needed to be learned there. And I think the one thing, the one thing that I probably take out of that one was really how ticked off everybody was that we didn't do well. And I thought to me, and now looking back, I'm thinking to myself, man, we had some guys that understood, that understood this is not good enough and we need to get better. And we'll take 4 years to get better. We'll take these 4 years and try and improve and try and make a mark that at least says, one thing I know we came out of that World Cup with, and regardless of what the results were or the rest of the world, and this is talking to players, talking to managers years after the fact, the rest of the world at least realized that this group can play. And hopefully that meant that they thought our country could play. And they, it was always a matter of trying to get respect from people. And I think that was our first step in doing that.
Looking into, of course, this is 25 years of Major League Soccer. I know at the moment, unfortunately, we're not having any games at the moment since week two, but for you being from Kearney, not far away from East Rutherford, New Jersey, and Giant Stadium at that time when the Cosmos were, of course, there. I know it was, a part of the movie, you and Tab and John, you're not far away driving-wise to get to Giant Stadium. To finally have that moment in 1996 to be signed by the Metro Stars, and at the same time, you and Tab being teammates for that 96 Metro Stars team, and you were there for a couple of years before you came back when the Red Bulls took over in 2006. How much fun was it, and how wonderful was it for you to be playing in front of not just your friends and family, but, in an area where it's, this is the shadows of soccer, back then, which was the NASL. Now it starts again with Major League Soccer, throughout that the beginning years of the league.
Yeah, look, my dream, I was a Cosmo ball boy, and I grew up, and Pele tells the story. Well, me and my best friend cut school, and we were, the cops came because we were trying to climb the fence. He would tell that story all the time, and Pele came over and he said, no, you let these guys in. And it was me and my best friend. I mean, we wanted to, we dreamed about it. We talked about it. I wanted to play in Giant Stadium. That was a goal. I wanted to play at home so my parents could see me play. I wanted to win a championship there. And that's the one thing that I have said forever. If I could go and give it one more shot, it would be to try and win a championship in New York, and try and do it. I say New York, and I apologize. I wanted to win that championship in New Jersey. That's where I wanted to win.
Of course.
It was in New Jersey. And it doesn't haunt me now, because I know that I laid it all on the line every time I played and wanted to win as bad as anybody did in that place. I guess I kind of hope that look, winning championships there is not over in my mind. There's other ways to win championships. I just won't be able to do it on the field. But again, it's one of those things. Growing up in that area, being part of the watching the Cosmos come through and being part of sort of that story in that time and that era was something that I grew up with. It's something that I dreamed and aspired to do, and was lucky enough to have the opportunity to play, play there and call that stadium home for a while.
Did you and Tab feel sad for John Harkes? I mean, look, I know he was signed by Bruce Arena to play at DC United. I know he was part of those first few championships that, he won in MLS Cup, Open Cup, Inter-America Cup, and all that stuff. But outside of that, did you feel sad that all three of you couldn't be on the same team at the same time?
I would have if John had wanted, if that was his first choice, and that was, John was already living in Virginia, Northern Virginia, with his wife, and You know, or that's where he was moving to. He had the history in Virginia. His wife is from there. They both went to school there. I think I'm happy because he ended up where he wanted to be. I always thought there would be a period of time where he would spend some time in New York and play there. I didn't think right from the start it would happen. It would have been great to have played together with him because that maybe would have been sort of an extension of the story a little bit. But, I mean, we're not feeling bad for John Harkes, I hope. A guy who's won a couple championships, a guy who played in England, a guy who's a successful coach right now and working on becoming better and better at his craft every day. I love the guy. And I'm always, and I'm telling him all the time, rooting for his success. And yeah, it would have been nice. Again, it would have just been part of the story here, but everyone, you know, at some point you got to write your own story. And I think we all kind of did that in our own ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, your story has been amazing. And, Tab, I want to go back to the World Cup in 94, obviously, in that game, the second rounder against Brazil. I mean, I think everyone knows about what happened to Tab. And, you know, you're on the field. You saw what happened, the flying elbow that struck him in the head and you know, the horrible injury he suffered. I know, obviously, you're thinking, you know, whoever's subbing in for Tab, next man up and all that other stuff. But if I can ask you this question, within your heart of hearts, and no one knows Tab better than you do, you've played with him in Kearney through the national team. If that situation never happened, do you feel there was an upset special coming or brewing against Brazil in your heart of hearts? Did you think that because the way he played against them and he frustrated them with the ball, that there was a possibility you were going to beat Brazil that day before the injury happened?
Yeah, I suppose you never know what can happen, right? And what ifs are, you know, part of everybody's life at some level. You know, I will tell you this. The one guy I thought from the start that we couldn't lose was Tab Ramos in that game because he was our most creative player. Hugo Perez had gotten a start in that game. He was the other maybe likely guy. Could have been Frank Klopas. But I think more than anything, going in at halftime and seeing the state that Tab was in, it took everybody back a little bit. If you weren't affected by that and seeing what was going on in that locker room and how the complete panic, because at that point I think they realized that, you know, Tab was in pretty bad shape. You know, I think it took over everyone's emotions at that moment. And it's not an excuse. There's no doubt that we lost the game, but I think there was a bit of focus that was lost. And then there was probably part of it that was a rallying cry as well, you know, in there. There was probably part of it that said, okay, you know, one of our guys is down, you know, everybody else has to step up here. And I'm sure we saw a little bit of that in there as well. But yeah, it was a scary moment. I never want to relive, you know, with any of my teammates or guys that I ever coach or you know, and yeah, did it change the face of the game? Yeah, but at that moment it was more about, I mean, we gotta make sure this guy's healthy. You know, and it was more about his life, and as he has told on numerous occasions, it was a matter of really life and death for him and forgetting the time that you know, you would have thought about continuing to play. That wasn't even a thought at one point. But, yeah, we gave it a go, man. We played. That team was so good, that Brazil team. And if you remember the first 10 minutes of that game, we had two opportunities to score. And it was like one of those days, like you kind of got that feeling when we played England a couple years before, like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe we're going to get this done. You know, maybe we're going to get this done here. And we fell short. But I think we, again, it's another one of those moments where we probably proved that we deserve to be on the field, against a very good team, a team that went on to win the World Cup.
No, absolutely. And of course, you know, with your club career with the Metro Stars, Sporting Kansas City, you won a title with Sporting Kansas City. Strangely enough, it was again in that final. It was either going to be either against Chicago Fire or the Metro Stars back in, I believe it was 2000. And unfortunately, it wasn't against the Metro Stars. It was at the time a three-game series against Chicago Fire. And you won it at RFK. You know, in your mind, which opponent were you looking to face? Your old hometown team, Chicago, or it didn't really matter to you? Whoever you faced in the East, you faced them in the East.
It really didn't matter. You know, everyone throughout the year, I would say if we took a vote of that team, we probably would have chosen Chicago. And I'll tell you why. So we opened up the season with Chicago in a wild, wild game where we won 4-3 at home. That was the first game of the year. We had gone, and I don't know how many teams have done it, we went wire to wire in first place. We had a 13-game unbeaten streak to start the year. Who broke it? It was Chicago, in Chicago. I believe it was 2-1 we lost. It was the 14th game of the year. It was kind of us in Chicago battling the entire season. And I guess it just, from our standpoint, was probably best that it was Chicago in the end, and we would kind of just figure it out one last time as to who was the team that was the best team in the league. I think that they probably on paper had the most talent. I think people look at our team, that team, and everyone says, oh, it's a great defensive team because we had all the shutouts and we did all that stuff. We were also the third highest scoring team in the league that year. So we just felt comfortable in close games, and I think that's why people look at us as a sort of a defensive team. But it was a solid team all around, a team that understood roles, that understood the meaning of what we were trying to do, understood what our owner, Lamar Hunt, wanted for that organization to continue to grow, understood Bob Gansler's mission as the head coach, and we just got it, and it clicked, and we ended up having a magical season.
You're one of the few players in this league that has played for your hometown team twice, obviously. Jaime Moreno played for D.C. in two separate moments. You have played for this team, you know, as well as Clint Mathis. The original version was the Metro Stars. Then, of course, after 2006, the New York Red Bulls. What was that like for you to go back home and to be back with your friends and family, back in Kearney and back at Giant Stadium for a second trip?
Yeah, that part, going back was good, for sure. You always want to – you never know if you're going to end at home, you know, where you started your career. I had the opportunity. I had better options, to go places, at that point. But Alexi was working there as the general manager, and he called and said, well, what do you feel about this move? It's one last chance for you to come home. And I just jumped at it because I looked at my wife, ideally, I would have stayed in Kansas City, but the way the rules were with salaries and all that stuff, they were making a change. As it turns out, we beat Chivas at the end of the year, which knocked Kansas City out of the playoffs in the last kick of the season. So it's kind of that part worked out where, you could at least prove that maybe they should have kept you for another year. But, I mean, I was thrilled to go back home and be close to my family and have an opportunity one more time because, my thought process when I left the first time was the move worked out great. I really wasn't looking for the move. It happened and I moved to Kansas City and, had a great run there. But I didn't really want to go. It wasn't my idea. It just ended up working out great. And I really wanted to stay in Kansas City when that was all said and done. But it just didn't work out that way. And I got to come home and there's never anything wrong with, getting home one more time.
I want to ask you this question because I remember this very vividly on MSG Network. Dr. Joe Matchnick, of course, he was the rules expert, for the laws of the game through FIFA and everything. It was at RFK where you had, I think, Chris Henderson was at one post. There was another Red Bull player on the other post. And apparently it was called passive offside. And you complained about it because even though Yuri Djorkaeff scored a fantastic free kick, at the time that was allowed to be considered a legal goal. And then, of course, later on they said, no, that's illegal now and all that stuff. You complained about that, I remember. I remember that. You complained about that could have been an offside or that goal be taken away, but it stood until later on they changed and realized, okay, there's a problem here. But you complained about that. Do you remember that at all about season?
If you're asking me, well, I remember the referees' meetings at the beginning of the year going through all the rules and guys sort of complaining. But if you're asking me which rule I complained about, boy, there's a long list. we'd be here all night trying to figure out which one it is. But I don't remember the exact play, but I remember the rule. And I vaguely remember having a conversation later on down the road with Dr. Joe. And, of course, I worked with him at the World Cup in 2018. We were in Russia together and spent an awful lot of time sort of reliving a lot of those moments. But, yeah, look, this is all stuff that's a work in progress. The rules are no different than the rest. Hell, I don't know how many rule changes we've been through recently. That particular sort of passive offside in front of the goalkeeper, I've had an argument about that for years and years and years, because I just think that too much of it is let go. I don't think people recognize sort of the guys that are in front of the goal, how much they impact the goalkeeper's decisions. But of course, this is a game to score goals, right? That's what everyone wants to see, and I guess that'll be the first thing that everyone tries to do is put more goals in the game, which I'm fine with, by the way, because I guess I don't have to be in goal anymore, so I guess that's why I'm fine with it.
Well, as they say in the trade, goalkeepers union, I don't blame you. now, of course, after your playing career is over, you had a stint as head coach of Jacksonville Armada back in the days when the NASL came back at the same time. After your little coaching stint, you are a broadcast analyst now. You were part doing a couple of Fox Sports games on Fox Sports 1. Now you're an analyst. Well, if you ever get back to it, calling Chicago Fire games locally on WGN Sports Television. Which part do you like the best? Do you like coaching, or do you like being an analyst?
Well, I kind of look at them as the same. When I first got to Fox, I hadn't really done all that much. I actually filled in for a game on a regional Fox network for a buddy of mine who kind of threw me into it, and I bailed them out of a mess, and I got a call from Fox, you know, and they said, well, you did a good job, and how do you look at the game? And I said, I kind of look at it as I'm coaching it, you know. That's kind of the take that I try and bring, or at least that's what's going through my mind when the game is happening. And then I kind of fell into this role. You know, I walked away from soccer for a couple of years after I was done playing and didn't know, you know, kind of what my role would be or what I wanted it to be. And then, you know, MLS, a guy at MLS pulled me in during the 2010 World Cup and said, you know what, you got to do some media for us. And he kind of talked me into it. And then kind of one thing led to another, and everyone said, oh, you should try this media thing out. And I was like, you know what? I work in radio and I work in media. It's a job for me for sure. And I love it. And I'm in the game. I just never thought I'd be doing this. I thought I'd be on the sideline, and I've had a couple of opportunities. I think eventually I will get back on the sideline, whether it's as a head coach or an assistant coach, only because I think my time in Jacksonville was cut too short. Yeah, we had some things to work out, but we had gone through so much and made so many changes. And I'm sure every coach who gets fired thinks that their time is cut too short. And that's how I felt about the situation and based on the plan that we had put in place. And I want to make that part right. There haven't, with regards to soccer, look, I don't think saying anything out of line. Most of the things I've done in soccer have ended up with some kind of success. And I need to, at some point, make the coaching part right. I coached for 20 years on the youth side. I'm not comparing youth to the pros and how you manage players and all that stuff, but I had success there, success at the DA, which obviously is no more for a short period of time. I had success there. And I just think it's one of those things that's kind of missing for me right now, and hopefully one day I'll get an opportunity. But for now, I work with great people on television. Lucky to be part of the Chicago Fire broadcast at WGN, which I grew up watching the Chicago Cubs on. I'm a big baseball fan. And I work on Sirius XM every day with great people, Brian Dunseth, my partner, and everyone behind the scenes. I really love, whether it's coaching or anything else, I consider myself fortunate, not because of the job, but because of the people I work with at the job. And I work with really great people. And sometimes if you don't have to, you don't want to lose that sort of momentum that you've got going. But yeah, one day I hope to be back on the field at some level and having some success. But for right now, this is the plan, to continue in this part of the game.
That's fantastic here. Yeah, Dunny's great. Dunny's a wonderful guy to have on a show, to be a part of a show. I have Sirius XM myself. You guys do a great job on the Counterattack show whenever you two are on.
Thank you.
You do a great job. And you know what? I also have to say this. And I will always go back to the Red Bull Atlanta United game over in Atlanta 2 years ago. It was the 3-1 win when Bradley Wright Phillips scored both goals in the second half. Your analyzing the ball by Michael Murillo was unreal. That was like the best thing that I've heard from you,
thank you,
analyzing the game. What is it about working with a legend in broadcasting like JP Della Camera? What is it about JP that he lets you breathe and lets you analyze while calling the game and talking about what's going on in the game?
Well, I think the great guys, they understand and at that point, JP and I were probably working for about 2 years on and off different games, Champions League, Europa League, MLS games, until we got to the World Cup, where we worked, you know, day and night. I mean, 24 hours a day. We hardly slept for 42 days while we were there, 45 days, whatever it was. And just kind of understanding each other's voice when you work with great guys, and they understand that they have someone who next to them who hasn't been working as long as they have, in my case, and that they need to sort of steer the ship in the right direction, and then you start to develop a groove. And I listened to everything he said in every meeting we had, every production meeting, every meeting with just our producer and he and I sitting there, our stats guys, and how we wanted to present it. And I took it all in, because at that point I said to myself, well, I'm going to the World Cup as an analyst, and I'm working with the best, and I may as well take this opportunity to learn absolutely everything that I can and just roll whatever JP said. That was it. Didn't matter. If I felt I wanted to do it some other way, I'd say, JP, tell me why I shouldn't do it this way. Give me a reason why. And he'd say, oh no, that sounds like a good idea. Or he'd say, well, you know, this is kind of how you should handle this situation. And then in the end, I never strayed from that. That was it. Whatever the man said, it was gold to me. And I think it worked out okay. I think our presentation together as a team was pretty good in the end.
So let me throw this at you now, because you've been to three World Cups, 1990 in Italy, 94 USA, and of course you were the third goalkeeper for 2002 in South Korea and Japan. Compare going to the World Cup as a player while going to the Russia World Cup in 2018 as an analyst. What's the differences?
Two different highs is how I would probably describe it. Two different highs, because you get equally as excited. Obviously, everyone wants to play, but then you realize down the road, you know, 20 years down the road, whatever it is, 15 years down the road, that you can't play anymore. But I prepared in each particular job. I think whether people, JP, you go back to JP, he told me two things: be prepared and be easy to work with for people. Those are the first two things he told me on the first day that we talked about broadcasting. We were getting ready to do The first game we did was Red Bull against NYCFC. NYCFC's first year at Red Bull Arena. And we, you know, I was prepared always, I thought, and I thought I was really easy to work with for people. And then from there, you just, the emotions to be in the stadium. I mean, JP and I did the opening game of the World Cup. The first time Fox was going to go on TV with the World Cup, it was JP and I. It was Saudi Arabia playing host to Russia, and it started Russia's run to the World Cup and all the dignitaries in the stadium. And it was just one after another after another. And we were, and as they explained to us in all our big meetings, you know, JP and I were the first two guys on in the stadium on the screen. And I think we kind of nailed the moment, you know, and how exciting it was. And we just rolled from there. It was a high to go to the stadium every day. I don't like going to the stadium like 4 hours early. It's never been my thing, dressed up in a suit and makeup and all that stuff. But if it were up to me, I'd hang out in jeans and a T-shirt, and we would have a friendly conversation. But other things have to happen in television, as you know. And that's how I took it. But I mean, playing in a World Cup is and again, playing in Italy, where my heritage, and then playing in the U.S., I couldn't ask for anything more.
Yeah, I don't blame you at all. That sounds really wonderful. Okay, I want to throw this scenario at you. Let's just say, for the hell of it, you become the head coach, whether it be back at Kearney High School or say the New York Red Bulls, and you decide to bring in Tab and John, and it's all three of you being the coaching staff. Which would be better, the high school job or the New York Red Bull job?
I guess like any coach, got to figure out the guys you got, right? Got to be with the best players. Now, I mean, any of them would be good. I'm not sure Tab, because Tab didn't play at Kearney High School. I'm not sure that he'd come back there to Kearney. He might go to St. Benedict's and do there. We might have a little conversation about that one, but I'm joking, of course.
Of course.
I don't know. I would love to one day. I've worked with Tab now for a bunch of years in the youth national team program, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. And I think more than or as much, I should say, as enjoying the work, that we did and the time we is that those moments that we spent together, kind of trying to figure out, we were players trying to figure out, you know, how we're going to beat the opponent. And that, you know, down the road, we were coaches, and I was his assistant coach, and he had me as an assistant coach in the youth national team programs and would always be around all the different age groups and just trying to figure out. I've learned so much from Tab and with regards to coaching style and how he wants things to look and how you can manage different situations. I'm really thankful to him.
That's fantastic to hear. And, I wish Tab a lot of success in Houston, hopefully, and he'll have a good season there.
He's got a tough job there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's a tough job. It's the lowest spending team in the league. It's a league that's spending more money, and he's just going to have to figure out sort of different ways to win, if you will. Find out different styles, different ways to bring players in, different ways to develop players. And he understood the role the minute he took it, and I'm sure he's going to do a good job.
I believe he will, because he's that good. He's that damn good. My last question to you, and I guess it's kind of like a personal question, if you don't mind me asking this. Throughout your entire career, whether it be for club or country, and I will reference the documentary based on you and Tab and John, why did you want to stop goals instead of scoring them? Because apparently – you were a damn good goal scorer. Why did you want to be a goalkeeper?
Look, when I was a kid, you know, I was the biggest kid, the fattest kid on the team, if you will. Luckily over the years, I grew up instead of out. And from the minute I I stepped in the goal the first night and came home and made my first diving save up at Harvey Field. And I remember my parents, you know, kind of said, ah, how'd you like that? You know, and I said, this is what I want to do. You know, this is what I want to do. I want to be in the goal. And I, you know, I've coached youth soccer for quite some time, and not a lot of times you get guys who just want to be in the goal. And I'm sure they saw that, and I stood there, and that's what I love to do. I still joke and let all my old coaches know that, you know, they weren't good enough because they didn't figure out I was actually a number nine, a center forward. They kept sticking me in goal. But we joke about it all the time. But no, it was the thrill for me, the thrill of changing the game in one play, much I would think like a goal scorer thinks the same way. The thrill of understanding that, you know, sort of all eyes are on you and your mistakes are magnified, and you have to understand that and want that. And that's what I wanted. You know, that's the moment I wanted, is to make the play that changes the game and have the pressure that, you know, if you make a mistake, you know, they don't always remember all of the times a guy misses a goal, you know, 3 feet away, but they remember every time a goalkeeper drops a ball. And I just liked that pressure. It was something that was appealing to me.
Tony, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's wonderful to go back memory lane with your career, what you're doing now, you know, starting this league off back in 96. And, of course, you made the country proud back in 94. I'm just glad you let that ball in against Colombia. I don't want to see anybody getting thrown in jail for streaking in a World Cup game.
it would have been his problem, not mine. But I appreciate it, man. Thanks for the time, brother.
You have a good night.
You as well. Take care.
Thank you. Take care. That's Tony Meola, former U.S. men's national team goalkeeper. 1990, 1994 World Cup, also 2002 World Cup. He played with the Metro Stars. Then, after spending many years in Kansas City at the Wizards and then Sporting Kansas City, of course, coming back as part of the New York Red Bulls. He's now a broadcast analyst, of course, with a year or two with Jacksonville Armada, then of the NASL. Just to have Tony on this show, on this program, it's wonderful to have that man on. My grandfather, my mother's father, was a big fan of his, and it was absolutely wonderful to have Tony come on. I've met him a few times and, you know, in the past, and you know, I've already mentioned to him before, you know, my grandfather's a big fan of yours, you know, my family coming from Eastern Europe and stuff, and, you know, and he loved to talk about Tony Meola and how great of a goalie he was for the United States. So just to have Tony talk about his career and now being a broadcast analyst for the Chicago Fire and, of course, for Fox Sports as well on FS1 for soccer, doing the World Cup. As an analyst, it's just been incredible and unbelievable to have this man be on the program tonight and to talk about all these wonderful things. But other than that, you know, that's what it was back in the day, you know. And this is what happens. The game grows. A lot of highs, lows. Currently in a low right now, but I really believe for our program, we are going to get better. We just have to hope that some people can get their acts together and get and move this whole situation forward, and we can be a lot better. Tonight, again, I want to thank my guest, Tony Meola, former U.S. men's national team goalkeeper, former playing goalkeeper for the Metro Stars, New York Red Bulls, and Sporting Kansas City and the Kansas City Wizards. My name is Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you very much for listening to me tonight. And as always, please enjoy your football. Please be safe. Please be vigilant. Please be aware of what's going on during this whole pandemic of COVID-19, the coronavirus. As always, please enjoy your football. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody. Take care. So long, and bye-bye for now.